We'll take a minute to cultivate our motivation. So we've been wandering in cyclic existence since beginning with time. Actually, wandering seems to infer that we have some choice. We've been tossed through cyclic existence like a pair of tennis shoes in a dryer, banging against all the rebirths round and round and round. And we've been born in every place, they say, the most horrible situations, the most blissful. But in all of that cycling, banging into one life after another, we haven't found the way out. So in this life, this moment, this human body, we've discovered in ourselves a kind of a longing that has been met by being able to meet the Dharma, whether in the form of books or teachers or both or what. Something resonates in us about the teachings of the Buddha. And the teachings of the Buddha, I mean, he gave those teachings to show us the way out of psychic existence, out of that banging dryer. And so, having met the teachings, we also then have an opportunity to begin to plant the seeds, to walk in the right direction that will lead us out of the cycle of existence. And as we look around, as we begin to head onto the path, we see that every other single being everywhere is in the same boat. They too have just been struggling and struggling and struggling without, at this moment, the causes haven't come together in order to have them move along the path out of cyclic existence. So for this time this morning, as we reflect on relying on the spiritual mentor, it's the very foundation of the path. Let's just set a motivation that we'll use this time or use this reflection to create the causes for ourselves to be able to continue to meet teachers life after life after life in order to progress quickly to the state of complete enlightenment. And let's think about all the beings in cyclic existence who are just like us. And set our minds towards that goal of enlightenment specifically in order to be able to teach them to become reliable guides ourselves, so that all living beings can be liberated from the cycle. Okay. So, we're on the same topic. And we're following Lama Tsongkhapa's outline, so I want to just go through the outline again. Maybe it was a teacher's outline, to tell you the truth. But anyway. We're following Lama Tsongkhapa's text, Lama Tsongkhapa. So the main topic is how to rely on the teacher, the root of the path. First point is a somewhat elaborate explanation for developing certain knowledge. And under that somewhat elaborate explanation are these three points. Defining the characteristics of the teacher, defining the general characteristics of the student, and then the third point, how the student relies on the teacher. And that's where we are. So underneath that C point, there's two big things. One is how to rely in thought, and the second one is how to rely in practice. So Venerable Tarpa started the how to rely in thought yesterday by talking about the general indication of the attitudes needed by the student to rely on the teacher. Actually, Venerable Children covered it too. So that's those nine points, that similes that we talked about. So today, the two other points under how to rely on thought, I'm going to cover in particular training in faith, the root, and remembering the teacher's kindness and being respectful. So that's still under relying on thought. Then I'll cover how to rely on practice. Which ones? I will cover them. So how to, in particular training in faith, remembering the teacher's kindness and being respectful, how to rely on practice. So I'm going to come back and cover all these. I'm just giving you the outline to start with. And then we'll close with the benefits of relying on the teacher and the faults of not relying on the teacher. So that's sort of the pattern of where we're going. So I used a lot of sources. I read Lama Tsongkhapa and I read some of Geshe Sofa's stuff, and I also went to Geshe Tekchak's teaching on the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, and I listened to some of Venerable Children's teachings on this topic. And I went to the 50 stanzas on the spirit of the guru. So it was synthesizing a lot of material. And it all comes down to, if you boil this whole part of the outline down to a few lines, it's those few lines that we say when we recite the 37 practices of the Bodhisattvas every 5 days. When you rely on them, your faults come to an end, and your good qualities grow like the waxing moon. Cherish spiritual teachers more than your own body. This is the practice of Bodhisattvas. That sums it up. When you rely on them, your faults come to an end. Because the benefits, what are the benefits? Your good qualities grow like the waxing moon. A benefit. How do we rely on benefit? Cherish spiritual teachers more than your own body. That's it. End of teaching. So Venerable explains a little bit this more than your own body thing. It is not so much about, you know, sacrifice yourself, but thinking about all the things that we, what do we spend most of our time doing through the day? We want to make sure we're fed well. We want to make sure we're well rested. We do all kinds of things to make sure that we're fed. You know, we do our jobs, we plan our food, we plan our housing, we plan for comfort, we buy nice blankets, we buy comfortable clothes, it's amazing, actually, if you start to think about how much of our mind is occupied with keeping ourselves not just alive, but comfortably alive. And so to take that level of concentration and apply that to caring for our teachers or trying to rely on our teachers with that kind of concentration, that is really how to rely on our spiritual teachers at the max. So, fortunately, Lama Tsongkhapa has given us a really clear outline for how to do these things. So it starts with thinking about the role of the spiritual mentors play, and this is covering a little, kind of a review of what we've been looking at the last couple of days. But they have an absolutely unique place in the pantheon of our relationships. There's nobody else like them. Our parents love us, usually. Our friends love us. They care about us. They do nice things for us. But can our parents or our friends teach us how to overcome our anger? Do our parents or friends want us to overcome our attachment? No. Can our parents or friends or anybody who's special in our life teach us about the nature of reality and help us to overcome our ignorance? No. So to find someone or someones who have that capacity and that willingness is extremely rare and precious. And so the more we think about how rare that the very thing that they're doing for us is, the more we come to appreciate the role of spiritual mentors in our life. And so the more willing we are to want to care for them more than our own body. Because, you just see that person down the street, that sort of Joe Schmo, like, who is she? Who is he? Who cares? But when we think about their role, that's where it becomes important. So the other thing is that the teachers are teaching like crazy. We can use Venerable Children as an example, but every Dharma teacher, every spiritual mentor that I know, to the best of their ability, does not refuse an opportunity to teach. You ask, they teach. You ask, they teach. His Holiness travels all over the world to teach. It's not like they're not giving. The onus of the relationship is from our side. They teach, do we show up? They give us instruction, do we follow? No, so, it, and as Venerable Children said the other day, nature of the relationship comes from the side of the student as well. You know, it's not like His Holiness is calling up everybody who ever bought a ticket and said, hey guys, are you practicing? They can't come out and like hook us in. So it's really our job. And I've had this attitude myself, and I see it in lots of us that we think, you know, well, it's kind of the teacher's job to keep us hooked. And they try. They do. They do. But if not, if we want teachings, we're the ones who have to make the relationship. And we make the relationship to the depth or to the level of personalness that we want. So given all of that, as described in the text, then the ways to rely on the teacher are these three things: to rely on thought. So that's particularly looking at developing these attitudes, training in faith, remembering the teacher's kindness. And then we rely on practice. So the thought button. And I was looking for this just the other day when she was talking, she said mainly, she was answering your question, she said mainly the relationship is in thought. Which I thought was very interesting and very telling, because as I had studied this, it's like, well, so we have lots to take care of internally ourselves in our relationship with the teacher. So this very first thing is the root, they say, is to cultivate faith. And faith is one of those words that can start to freak us out, because faith is what they wanted in the last religion. And there wasn't a whole lot of reasoning for it. You know, so some of us really came up against that. And also I think because of that, we think that faith is sort of an emotional response. You feel full-hearted and you feel loved and connected. And I mean, it has this whole feeling quality to it. But the kind of faith that we're talking about here, another good word for that is confidence. Or you could even go with trust. And the kind of faith that we talk about in the Buddhism is not faith that's just based on emotional content or attachment, which will only hang us, trust me. But it's a faith that's based on reason, based on sound conclusions, based on like thinking through these steps and then also applying them and proving to ourselves that they work. So it's the same principle that we've been talking about all along with what the Buddha says about the Dharma. Investigate, investigate, investigate. And on the basis of that investigation, then our faith grows. And in this case, our faith in the teachers or teacher. So given that, Geshe Sopa said a really beautiful thing about faith. He said it's one of the most important qualities in any religious practice. You need faith in the goal, faith in the method, and faith and confidence in the teacher, the person who's teaching them. So with this particular teacher, he says, we are embarking on a most unusual road. We are seeking a remarkable goal. It is not an ordinary or a worldly goal. We are seeking something that is far, far beyond the object of our senses or our ordinary experience. Emancipation or enlightenment. So since our reliance on this guide, we need to trust our guide, and the reliance must be complete and heartfelt, so the faith on which it is based must be equally firm and sincere. So that we don't start out with that faith. We need some ways to cultivate it. So they talk about three different kinds of faith. And Geshe Sopa actually gives them a different order than we've had them taught before, but I thought his order was interesting. The first kind of faith, he calls it beginning faith. Venerable Chodron uses the words admiring. But it is the faith that actually probably gets us started on the path, where you connect with the person or you connect with the teaching. And, you know, that strikes some sense of feeling of admiration or interest or an affinity. So that's good. It gets us going. But it's not very stable. It's not really based on much. Then he says that as we begin to check things out, We begin to practice, we begin to test the teachings against our experience, we begin to check the teacher against our experience, then our conviction grows. So this faith based on conviction then is what's really stable. And we can continue to work on that for years to develop our conviction more and more and more, so that the stability is such that if we're looking at simile of having a diamond-like relationship, it's based on something like this. And then there's wishing or aspiring faith that has the feeling so strong that you want to obtain those same qualities. And that is really your inspiration. This aspiration to become like the teacher, the aspiration to become like the Buddha, the aspiration to become the Dharma itself. You know, those great, great, great goals that we make. And that kind of faith, will never separate you from the path. But in the beginning, it's that beginning faith, that admiring faith. And so in order for that to grow, it's a dangerous thing. You know, I was thinking a lot about my experience of watching Dharma students over the many years as I was studying this material. You know, there's a delicate place when people first come to the Dharma that they get very excited about it and they really want to practice. And then, it starts getting hard. Mm-hmm. Or you start seeing the clay feet of your teacher or something. And if we don't have a solid enough foundation to begin to know how to think and work with those things, then out the door we go. And so it's karma, it's whatever, there's no judgment about that. But as students, no matter where we are in the path, we can help prevent that from happening to us by cultivating these kinds of faiths really intentionally. So one of the things about developing faith in the teacher in particular is then to meditate on their good qualities and do it again and again and again. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has a great quote. It says, "The actual method of cultivating the correct attitude toward the spiritual master is to practice contemplative meditation upon the guru's good qualities and the beneficial effects that he or she introduces into one's life. By reflecting again and again on the great kindness the guru performs, a confidence suitable for spiritual training under him or her is born." So it's not just enough to go, "Oh, they're really great, I really love my teacher," and sort of have that in mind, but you really have to think about, what are the benefits of being in this relationship? What is their kindness, really? What does that mean, the teacher is kind to me? They smile, they don't smile. Where's the kindness? That's something you really have to think about a lot. And then what are the good qualities of the teacher? There's a wonderful story in Lama Tsongkhapa, just a little blip, where Dzongtopa is talking to a teacher. And he says, "In Tibet, there are many who are meditating and practicing, yet they are not attaining any special good qualities." And the teacher turns to Dzongtopa and he says, "All the significant and insignificant good qualities that pertain to the Mahayana, or the great vehicle, arise from relying on a guru. You Tibetans only think of gurus as being common persons. How can a good quality arise?" And I think for us Westerners, we have the same problem. We see a Tibetan teacher. We see a Tibetan teacher who doesn't even speak English or who wears the right kind of, la-la clothes. It's a little bit easier to see them as something greater than we are. But our Western teachers, they went to the same high school. They ate the same macaroni and cheese. They, what's so special about them? BFP, So it is so easy to go there in our minds. So this attitude of cultivating... really thinking about the good qualities of the teacher, I think can help us a lot to be able to be more humble to take teachings from whomever is qualified, not just the ones who wear the right clothes or who were born in the right country, for us to have that kind of faith. So another thing, the opposite of meditating on their kindness is to really practice not finding faults. Really, really, really. The Tantra bestowing the initiation is all this Vajrapani. Keep the master's good qualities in mind, never seize upon their faults. Keeping their good qualities in mind, you will reach attainments. Seizing upon their faults, you will not. Pretty simple. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, completely cast aside your conception of faults in the guru and train yourself to discern the guru's good qualities. And the closer we are with our teachers, the easier it is to see through our own obscured vision all the things they don't do the same way I do. I was thinking about this in the last couple of days, of how many times in my life of serving the children, especially when she was getting the Abbey started, and the Friends of Srivasti Abbey was coming together, and there was a thought in my mind, it's like, you know, she's been a nun since she was 20-something years old. What does she know about running an organization? She's been a nun since she was 20-something years old. What does she know about food in the kitchen? She's been a nun since she was... what an arrogant little snit, you know? But for sure, that mind was there and has been was an obstacle. You know, and actually, I've worked on it a lot. But it's so easy for that kind of thought to come in. I think I know something. We all think we know something. And here is this person who's got a different idea. Well, what does she know? I mean, she's been studying the Dharma. So they're tricky, those ways of picking faults. It may not even appear as fault picking. Something that Venerable Tridran brought up in the last few days, she's been teaching on this topic in the Bodhisattva Breakfast Corner. But I think it's important to remember in this whole area of developing faith and picking faults is that the reliance really is on the ultimate good. That when we're relying on the teacher, the ultimate guru is the omniscient mind of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya. And the teacher is the representative of that ultimate guru. So it's the Dharma coming through that teacher, those teachers, whoever they are. It's the Dharma coming through them that we really want to respect, that we want to cultivate faith in. Of course, that mind then is influencing the actions of body and speech. But it's not the personality of the teacher. Who cares? I mean, really, that's where we get plugged in. The personality is it's not the personality that we're taking refuge in. It's the Dharma that they're leading us in. And that's so tricky. But a good thing to remember. And I think it'll help us think about this thing about faith without getting into so many weird trips about my teacher's a Buddha, my teacher's not a Buddha, is my teacher a Bodhisattva, I don't know. They act like a Bodhisattva, but sometimes they act like a jerk. Really irrelevant, all of that, because it's the Dharma that we are seeking, and that's what we're cultivating our faith in, that comes through in the body of that person. And so, if we have a mind like that, then we can really begin to see that the teacher is teaching us exactly what the Buddha would be teaching if the Buddha was sitting here in front of us. So if we cultivate that faith, that's what leads us to the next step of remembering the teacher's kindness and being respectful. So that's point C. So training in respect or gratitude by remembering the kindness of our spiritual mentors has 4 points. The first one is that the teacher is kinder than all of the Buddhas. And in particular, the teacher is kinder than Shakyamuni Buddha. So it's in particular because we especially appreciate Shakyamuni Buddha because Shakyamuni Buddha was the one who happened to be born at the time when we are born, not exactly the same time, but it is, you know, that turning of the wheels that we are able to take advantage of the teachings. So he attained Buddhahood and taught during our eon, during our era, which was incredibly fine, because without him there would be no Dharma that we know of. And yet, we didn't have the karma to be born at the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, or if we did, we were an ant crawling up, who knows where we were. So he's passed into parinirvana. So who teaches us? Well, our teachers. So that's why our teachers are kinder even than the Buddha, because without them, we have no access to Dharma. So to really meditate on that, they are the way we get access. So then, having concluded that our teachers are kinder than the Buddha, then they're kind in three ways. So first of all, they're kind by teaching the Dharma, which is vast. Without them teaching the Dharma, we perpetually engage in negative actions that lead us to lower rebirths, or lead us to suffering and human rebirths. Because we don't know any better. Without them teaching the Dharma, we don't have an aspiration to be anything. To have a good rebirth. We don't have an aspiration to have liberation and enlightenment. Without the teachers teaching the Dharma, we have no tools to overcome our afflictions, to deal with our anger, attachment, our craving, our pride, our jealousy, all that blah blah. No way. And without them teaching, we have no way of developing our love and compassion and wisdom. So, you know, the kindness in teaching the Dharma is just vast. Then the second way they're kind is that they're kind in inspiring us and blessing our mind streams. So this, too, has a couple of interesting levels. Lama Tsongkhapa alludes to a story that Tibetan Buddhism is just full of these kinds of things, that Dromtopa, again, was serving Atisha when he was very, very old and sick. And on the basis of his deep service, he was carrying out Atisha's poop, but, you know, just like getting rid of it every day. And on the basis of that faith and devotion, he had like incredible I don't know if it was samadhi, but he had these incredible mind-blessing experience just from relating to his teacher's excrement. So you think, wow, that's an inspiration. But it's not because Atisha had magical poop. You know, it's the basis of the faith and the faith and the care that Dromtopa had for his teacher that inspired that inspiration in his mind. So this is, again, a place where we get tricky. We get a little confused, you know, that, oh, the teacher inspires me by giving my protection cord, you know, which I still wear. The teacher inspires me by giving me money pills, or I get something from the teacher. And that can have, you know, a lot of symbolic benefit. But the teacher inspires us because of how we have faith and confidence in their kindness, how much we trust their serving. And then there's a more mundane way that our teachers inspire us. You know, when we stay near them, when we, you know, visit them, or when we do retreats with them, or come live with them for any period of time, we do what they do. And what do? They hear, think, and meditate. They practice. So, as you spend time with your teacher, short or long, you also spend time listening to the teaching, thinking about the teaching, meditating on the teaching. So of course that inspires your mind. Now they also, by being in relationship with the teachers, we see their joyous effort, which inspires us. We see their patience, which inspires us. You know, they demonstrate how to live a life filled with Dharma, and so that's part of what inspires our mind. And so I think that's very, very beneficial. You know, people talk about how coming to the Abbey does that for their practice. You know, they're they're good long-time practitioners. You really have a strong daily practice, but go out in the world looking for examples of how they want to live. Hard to find. So, you know, checking in with a teacher that they know well, just coming to spend time, seeing how that teacher practicing is an inspiration. So that's another way the teachers are kind, is that they inspire minds. And then the third way our teachers are kind is, according to the textbook, is that they are kind by including us in the circle of beings whose material needs they care for. So, again, this would apply to monastic students, disciples. And did I ever say this here or BBC? I don't remember. But generally speaking, for Western monastics, this is not the case, that the situation is such that the situation is such that Western monastics, especially in the Tibetan tradition, their teachers are people in exile. Right? They can't care for them. But here, the Sarasvati, we're actually quite fortunate to have a teacher who's kind in that way. And so for the lay students, of course, it's not appropriate for the teacher to be providing materially. But I would say in this case, in this particular case, Venerable Chödrön creating a monastery where people can come and practice is providing in a very material way. So there's teaching, providing the teachings is one aspect, but the actual creation of places where people can come and be and study and, is another way that the teacher is kind. And so everybody who sets up Dharma centers, I think you could, as a layperson, extrapolate that a little bit and say, yeah, they're providing materially. If I didn't have a Dharma center to go to, where would I learn? They don't teach on the street corner. So here's a Ten Teaching Sutra. It's kind of a meditation. Maybe I should print this out if people want it. Because Lama Tsongkhapa says, so recollect your teacher's kindness in regard to these statements, and then imagine your teacher's in front of you. And as you say these words out loud, concentrate one-pointedly on their meaning and replace the word they, which is the pronoun, with these teachers or my teacher or your teacher's name. Right? So here's the sutra text. Develop the following ideas with respect to your teachers. I have wandered for a long time through cyclic existence and they search for me. I have been asleep, having been obscured by delusion for a long time, and they wake me. They pull me out of the depths of the ocean of existence. I have entered a bad path and they reveal the good path to me. They release me from being bound in the prison of existence. I have been worn out by illness for a long time, and they are my doctors. They are the rain clouds that put out my blazing fire of attachment and the like. So that's the kindness of the teachers. This is the Ten Teaching Sutra, and it's in Lamrim Chenmo. I think this one about I wandered through cyclic existence and they search for me, that's something that I have some questions about. It's not that they're out with their little net. But, you know, there's a teaching on how to gather disciples. They are making themselves available to anybody who has the karma to hear. So I don't think it's searching so much as it is... it is, maybe. Making the karmic connection with anyone who wants to hear the Dharma. Venerable Chödrön jokes with Venerable Simke about her feeding the turkeys as gathering disciples. But it's not a joke. She is making a karmic connection with these beings, and someday, when they are born as humans and she is born as a teacher, that connection will manifest in her capacity to teach them. So in that way, yes, our teachers are searching for us. Venerable Rabina tells wonderful stories, but she tells a story about how, I don't think it was her mom, but maybe it was her mother, who met Lama Yeshe and was kind of, you know, I don't know about this. I don't know if I want to have anything to do with this. And he just kept she wasn't very welcoming, which was not like her mom at all, but he just kind of stayed with her and asked her questions until she finally made eye contact with him. And then that was good enough. And Rabina said, I know he was making that karmic connection. It's the intentionality of walking through life, making that karmic connection so that when we meet again, whoever knows, some eon, it's me. So, so in that way, there is searching going on. You know. See, what else in here is kind of confusing? I have been asleep and obscured by delusion. Anybody have any questions about that? I have entered a bad path and they revealed a good path to me. They released me from being bound in the prison of existence. I have been worn out by illness, the illness of ignorance. The illness of my afflictions. I am worn out by the illness of my afflictions. And they are my doctors. They are the rain clouds that put out my blazing fire of attachment and the like. So Geshe Jampa Tekchuk says, if we think positively about our spiritual guides, our wishes are correspondingly fulfilled. Now, how does that work? He says, for example, if we think the room we live in is cramped and dark and airless, we become unhappy, miserable, I think. If we think the same room is just right, spacious and open, it makes our mind happy to think that way. Nothing has changed but our mind. So in the same way, if we think our teacher is generous, kind, who's leading us on the path to enlightenment, who has our best interest at heart, who is learned, who has compassion, who has wisdom, our minds are happy and we trust that person. If we think our teacher is cranky, picky, too detail-oriented, pushes too hard, has too many projects, makes too many ideas, then we're miserable. Same person. We can even see the same qualities as being great. This person wants nothing but to give the Dharma and so everybody can have it. That's really fantastic. This person makes us give retreats weekend after weekend after weekend. What a drag. I mean, you can go either way. Same person. So that's where relying on, thinking about the teacher's kindness is over and over and over. It helps cultivate that quality in our mind. There's a thing in here. Did I already pass it? The Lama Tsongkhapa just says, if you have a habit of cultivating, of looking at faults in your teacher, stop. And that's pretty much what he says. I'll probably come to it. If you see that habit in your mind, just stop it. So it's dangerous. It's actually quite dangerous. And Geshe Tekchuk says the same thing. The main thing to avoid in relating to our spiritual mentor is anger, resentment, and belligerence. They're a tremendous field of merit. We have been hearing this over and over. So creating negative karma in relationship to them has some heavy weight. And if we get angry enough to walk out the door, we are cutting off our access to the path. So it's a big deal. However, he says reassuringly, should these thoughts arise, and they do, you can purify them with the four opponent powers. So our kind teacher, Buddha Shakyamuni, has given us a way of dealing with the fact that we have affected minds and will have anger at our teacher, but you can really purify that. It's not like deadly. So having developed faith and thinking about our teacher's kindness, then we rely on them in practice. So this is the place where we've done our mental work and now we show up. We put it into practice. As Vagosha's 50 stanzas on the Guru, 50 verses on the Guru, has a lot of good tips for how to relate to the teacher, and we'll have time, I'm going to go through some of them. But here is where Lama Tsongkhapa quotes him. What need is there to say much here? Do whatever pleases the Guru. Eliminate all that displeases them. Analyzing this, start at it. Do whatever pleases Guru. Eliminate all that displeases him. And this means in practice. So the three avenues to achieve what pleases your Guru: offering material gifts, respecting and serving with the body and mind, and practicing according to their wishes. Maitreya's ornament for the Mahayana Sutra says, rely on the teacher by way of respect, material things, service, and practice. So, making offerings to the teacher. We know from our study that generosity is one of the best and beginning practices for cultivating merit, positive potential in ourselves, for developing an open mind and open heart. And our teacher is such an important figure, and karmically speaking, somebody that's so valuable for creating merit. So making offerings to our teacher only benefits us. We gain tremendous positive potential for making offerings again and again and again to the teacher. We create great karma. So it's good for our practice. In a more practical way, our teacher needs food, clothing, medicine, home, housing. And so if students don't provide for them, then they would have to get jobs and then they wouldn't be teaching. So this is a benefit for us to make offerings to the teacher repeatedly. From the side of the teacher, they do not expect this, and they have to really work. You know, that's one of the qualities to be looking for, is that if a teacher is teaching for money, they're not, that's a checkoff on the not-so-qualified teacher list. So it can't be coming from your side. This is from our side. So the 50 Standards on the Guru has a couple of things about this. It says, giving to your teacher is the same as making continual offerings to all the Buddhas. That's pretty big. From such generosity, much positive potential is gathered. From such collection comes the supreme actual attainment of Buddhahood. So you get that progression. Giving your teacher is the same as giving to the Buddhas. You get tremendous positive potential from giving in that way. And from that positive potential, from that collection of merit, comes the supreme attainment of Buddhahood. Therefore, giving to your teacher leads to Buddhahood. That's the short path. It's a very good reason to do it. Whenever you make an offering to your teacher, or whenever your teacher presents you with something, a practitioner will present and receive this using both hands with head slightly bent. So just... So that's a way to do it respectfully. Okay, so making offerings to teacher, that's one way. The second way to rely on the teacher is respecting and serving them with body and speech. So this also creates great positive potential. So our teachers need help with all the projects. There are many projects. The projects that they are engaged in are specifically to benefit others. Therefore, when we do projects for our teachers, we are engaged in benefiting others. So we're fulfilling our own aspirations to be of benefit. We make prayers about it all day long. So serving our teacher does that. And also then we create the positive potential or the merit from engaging and benefiting vast numbers of people. I mean, speaking personally, far more people than I would meet in a given day or a given year or a given lifetime. So by serving a teacher, we benefit many, 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 many more people. Then there was that whole little section that we laughed about, but that whole section on the nine qualities of the students, where we talked about the student being like the earth and willing to take the whole burden of the teacher's activities. and to do it willingly. So serving the teacher cultivates that quality in our minds as students. All of these ways of serving the teacher actually cultivate those qualities. It's kind of a nice way to develop them. And then there's another story about Drontopa and Atisha. That among Atisha's students, there was a meditator who was quite progressed and a little bit proud of his meditation experience. And I don't know what provoked this, but there was something about how much attainments and how many attainments he had. So Atisha said, okay, he was just going to test these students and see where they were. So he tested the meditator, he tested his cook, and he tested Drontopa, who was the one who was his attendant and his principal student, who had hardly any time to meditate at all. So Drontopa, you may recall, was the one who, when with Atisha, they came to that muddy place, he took off all his clothes and cleaned up all the mud and scattered the dirt from the teachings earlier on. Okay, so this is Drontopa. So upon testing their attainments, I assume with his clairvoyant powers developed by his mind, what Atisha discovered was that Drontopa actually had the most developed qualities and attainments. The cook was second, and the meditator was third. So, for all of us who wish that we could just spend more time on the cushion and less time in front of the computer or in the woods or wherever it is that we are creating merit. We are creating merit. And possibly attainments as we do work for the teachers. So again, 50 stanzas on the Guru talks about actually these three are one of them is a little bit of an etiquette, but it leads into this how to serve. So never sit on the same bed or seat as your teacher or walk ahead of him or her. The teachings don't wear a hat. Never touch a seat before the teacher sits down, da da da. Never sit or recline while your teacher is standing. Always be ready to stand up and serve your teacher in a skillful and excellent manner. So that implication is, to our feet, how can I serve you? That sort of, which is that quality of life as servant. Then, after doing what your teacher has asked, report what has happened in polite, gentle words. So that's how we rely on our precedent. Respecting and serving with body and speech. Yeah?
Is that 50 stanzas from the practice of time?
Yeah. But there's lots of... I mean, there's some that we want that don't apply, but lots of them do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the third way of relying on the teacher is to practice according to their words or according to their teaching. This means practice without contradicting what the guru asks you to do. Sounds easy, doesn't it? This is the supreme offering to make, says Lama Tsongkhapa. Oh no, this is Venerable Children. This is the supreme offering to make. Our spiritual guide teaches us the Dharma, so we'll be happy. When we practice as they instruct, they are delighted because they know that we will be helping ourselves and helping others to do this, to be happy. So our practice is the ultimate, practicing in the way that they have taught. So, this is also Venerable Children, relying on our spiritual mentors means attending their teachings and retreats. Now, you would be surprised how difficult that seems. I mean, it's really, this show up is the very first thing. When I know people have lives, busy lives, you know, and long-time students that really, really have lots of respect for Venerable Children. She goes through town and teach, they can't make it to the teaching. So just making that effort to get there is the first way that we rely on our teachers in practice. Is to get there and find out what they're teaching so we can practice it. And not just hear that teaching the first time. You know, you don't like, oh, well, she's already taught on how to rely on a spiritual guide. I don't have to show up for that one. Because, of course, every time you hear it differently. So that showing up bit is big for us. To show up again and again and again and again. So we need to listen, we need to learn, we need to practice. The primary way the Buddha helps us, if we want to rely on the Buddha as our refuge, the primary way the Buddha helps us is by teaching the Dharma. So we need to go where the Dharma is being taught to be helped by the Buddha. We need to pay attention, we need to put it in practice. So this is Geshe Thich. When we have strong confidence, trust, respect, and gratitude for our spiritual guides, the path is generated more quickly in our mind streams. This is the purpose of developing confidence and gratitude. So again, it's not to please the teacher, which is a hard thing. We're not doing this to please our teachers. We're not doing this to make them happy. We're doing this because what makes them happy is that we progress along the path. That's the kind of happy we need to make them. And, yeah, this is tricky. But this is the purpose for developing our confidence and our gratitude. And they say, when we feel there is no mentor apart from the Buddha, and no Buddha apart from the mentor, then we see the two as inseparable, then we have this realization. So when we have the confidence or the trust and the faith in our teacher, that the very words of the Buddha himself, the pure Dharma is coming out of their mouths and into our hearts, and we see no distinction, that's when we have that realization. It is a progression. It's not where we end up. I mean, it's not where we start out, unless you have tremendous karma. Yeah, so those are the ways to rely on the teacher. Are there any questions before we go into the benefit part or comments? About seeing the teacher and the Buddha as inseparable?
I understand that, but what is the, I guess I didn't know what your what realization you're connecting with, that kind of confidence?
Yeah, the realization, then we've gained the realization of this point.
Of confidence.
Yeah, of the relying on teacher.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of the whole... Topic.
That's where I got it.
When you fully rely. That's what you're gonna get.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you say a little more about the faith based on reason? Different
from emotion.
Faith.
Yeah, I think all of the reasonings actually that are that follow in reflecting on the kindness of the teacher, it's like that's part of the reason there. And then the faith that's based on putting the things into practice and seeing the results. Yeah, it's experience. Yeah, but both Geshe Sopa and Geshe Thich talked about how we do it based on reasoning, and that is partly that experience. Yeah. And thinking, you know, thinking about what do you really get? What do you really get from the teachers? Yeah. Did you ever have it?
I did. Thanks, clarity. When we're asked to do something, and we don't, well, it's not blind faith. We're not just doing it just to do it. And so I guess if I don't agree with something and I question it, which is what we're taught to do, at what point do we, Are we being disrespectful to go back to the teacher and say, I don't agree, please help me understand better? Or do we have that faith and that trust, and then at that point, if we are at that point, that we just do it and then find out for ourselves in that way?
Well, I think the experience we've had here is that if we really don't agree strongly and have, you know, like a really, it may be that we misunderstood the direction, or, I mean, so go back and check.
So clarification.
Yeah, go back and check. Go back and check. I think, yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. we've all had some sort of that in this particular teacher relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I also would say personally that there is a place where I pretty much now will just do it. But that is a hard one process. I mean, and if it feels really, really, really wrong, I won't. But I have now come to realize that so much of the things that I think are not right are just my style. You know, I don't really, like, I mean, a real simple thing is plane reservations. When I started making plane reservations for Venerable Children way before I lived here, I made plane reservations for her like I make them for me. Well, that wasn't the way those plane reservations should be made. There's a whole different set of criteria that I had to learn where, you know, my way is way faster, it is way simpler, and in my view, it comes to about the same price. So give me a break and do it my way. I mean, let me do it my way, right? You want me to help you? Let me do it my way. Well, I have learned that if I want to help, I will do it the way that I am asked to be done, in the way that the person I'm serving wants it done. Yes, it's more time consuming. I've come to appreciate the value or the need for detail. It's actually a different kind of mind. Mm-hmm. You know? So what I've come to learn is that very, very often my original, like, I don't want to do it that way. Why would you do it that way? Is just this is my trip. Mm-hmm. It's not really that it's wrong. I mean, I disagree because it's a style thing. Anybody else?
I couldn't understand your question if you were talking about projects, like worldly projects, or if you were talking about
Dharma and
Dharma.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, both, actually. I think both.
Because Venerable has said a number of times, you know, there's kind of like, they're kind of almost different things in some sense. Like there's one part where she wants people really to speak up. Especially when you're working on projects, if you have expertise in an area, don't assume the teacher knows everything. You know, and sometimes that doesn't happen. You know, it's in the same line she said, like sometimes people think that the guru is a Buddha so they don't have to take care of him when he's sick. He has a human body. You know, so you need to take care of him. It's that same kind of thinking that sometimes we don't question anything, but, you know,
yeah.
She's actually told us a number of times, you know, you need to have input on these things.
And I think being at the Abbey, that all kind of webs together all those different levels, too, at least for me. You know, they all seem to be one and the same, and yet they're not.
Right, because no matter if it's a Dharma topic or a mundane project, you're always being taught.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And at the same time, having given your input, if the decision remains the same, then arguing is not appropriate either. You know, I mean, there's that place too. So I think there's a lot of subtle discernment about what we need ourselves to be clear and feel comfortable about what we're doing, and whether we have to feel comfortable about what we're doing. What's really offering some point of view that could have a lot of benefit here, or what's just putting in my two cents that I'm kind of attached to?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, having been here about 14 months, the issue I'm working on with this and my involvement with people is capacity. And it's a complex thing because, I'll just tell a little example and then say what I'm getting out of it. So Venerable and I were out in the woods kicking these ceremonial things to the Nagas, which we do once a year, and we had walked, for me, pretty far, And she can walk and walk and walk. Probably, I don't know what the limit is, but 20 hours? I don't know. But with no sense of tiredness. And so when we got to this certain place, then she said, let's go way up this mountain and back down. Up another way. And I just said, I don't think I can do that today. So she said, oh, okay. Well, then let's just do this little short thing and come back. So then I got to start thinking about capacity, like, you know, you're always wondering, would that have been more of a teaching for me to go do that and come back down and increase my capacity, or because I have some health concerns, would it have been a thing that wouldn't have been good for me, you know? And you're left with these questions, which I think are good meditations, you know? Because what I'm coming to understand, instead of being irritated at the huge vision she has and the huge projects and the next one, which is my usual thing, is, oh no, you know, we can't have to do this, can't we just have a week vacation? instead of having that towards her, which has nothing to do with her, just rather to figure out my own capacity and push a little. And come back to myself instead of, oh, she's doing that, so I must do it all, you know, and then crash. So I'm just kind of saying that's been my process, and I'm trying to find the more middle way between outright rebellion, no, I don't want to do it, so I'm just going to disappear and go do eat cookies in bed. Or I will just do it till I drop, you know, and I'm pissed off, frankly. So between those two, there's some kind of better place to be, and it helps me to find it through capacity. Just going, wow, she's all this capacity. I would like that someday, and to get there, I'm going to need to stretch. But right now, I don't have that. And if I try to do that, I'm going to be not a nice person to be around. So, that's terrible. But so, anyway, that's all.
Thought I'd offer something that occurred to me with a combination of the idea of being a dutiful child, you know, and faith, and the yesterday, when Venerable Tarpa was talking about the if the teacher berates you, all of a sudden I thought of, and I've never had a teacher berate me, but all of a sudden I thought of my grandmother, who I sort of see a connection between my grandmother and Venerable Sharan, because I see them both as very strict people, very nurturing to me. And I was in a cab with my grandmother, her best friend, her best friend's granddaughter, and me, and we were in San Francisco, big trip to city, and the door flew open as we went around the corner, and my grandmother reached across all four people and grabbed my arm and you know, pinched me. And I wasn't about to fall. I didn't think I was about to fall out of the car. And why did she have to be so rough, you know? And then later, when I spend time with friends who feel like they have to explain every single thing to their toddler, and the toddler is about to run across the road, you know, I grab the toddler. Don't let him run across the road. But the friends who have to explain everything first, the kid's halfway across the road. So that kind of became my way of framing those issues.
That's a great analogy. Yeah. Yeah. Only we're not just falling out of the cab, we're falling straight to the hell realm. Or the animal realm. I mean, that's freaky enough, right?
No, we think we're just sitting there.
Yeah. Oh, it's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question. It was kind of a last time we were going over yesterday about being a suitable vessel, so to speak. And so a question that I've had has to do with kind of the qualities that we want to develop, you know, for ourselves, and also the timing of developing those qualities. Like, you know, do you wait until you have these qualities, then look for a teacher? Or are you trying to develop them? Like, do you have to have a teacher to develop, you know, to be able to develop them?
I'll give you my take, and Venerable Tarpa may have something too after having studied this a bit, but it's all comes together at the same time. You know, if you don't have a teacher, then I think the more you can cultivate these qualities before finding such a person, the more receptive you'll be when you do. If you do have a teacher and then suddenly, you know, you've been practicing for 10 years, sort of stumbling along as best you can, and then you come along a teaching that says, oh, how to relate, it's time to probably practice those. You know, so there's, and there's no, like, goal. It's not like when we're practicing the Dharma that you can't go to the next level until you've passed the test. You know, I mean, definitely we progress. It is a progression, and we all move at our own rate and our own speed. And you know, there's strong teachings about not taking high tantric initiations until we're ready. So there, it's that. But it's not like we don't practice if we don't have something. We have met the teachings, we practice what we can, what we know, as we can, right now. Does that answer that question? Is there something more specific, or do you have a take on it, Parpa?
Can you restate your question? I think I understood, but I just want to be sure.
Yeah, and actually by your answers, I think my homie you stated a little bit differently, which was, especially some of the qualities that they're talking about, I don't think you can really develop those until you have a teacher. It's kind of like in relationship.
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, almost. I mean, some of those things, yes, you can really work on your mind and how you can do all those things, mm-hmm. but it seems like some of those you can't really develop until you really start making some kind of strong
mm-hmm.
connection.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more about that, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know if
that makes sense to me, having studied them, but I think what I understand your first question was kind of like being. You develop these first, and then you have a teacher, or you have a teacher first, and then you develop them.
Yeah, she could be waiting.
Yeah.
You could be like, oh, I'm not capable of this right now.
Right.
Should I wait? Yeah.
That part of the question, I think, basically, when you're ready, you're going to have a teacher. And so, if you know, I think the main thing is just practice the Dharma, and when you're ready, you'll have a teacher. And if you find that you do the teachings on the, I think, when people are searching for a teacher and if they find that they're very critical, closed-minded people, then they're probably not going to find a teacher. And in that case, I think they should, you know, I don't know how it would necessarily happen because it's hard to see that in oneself. That's the great thing about having a teacher is they point out things that we can't see, but maybe through Dharma friends or study, the person would come to see that they need to open their mind a little bit.
There's also a thing here where, you know, we've been focusing on the teacher. And, you know, it's this whole teaching, or this whole sharing of Dharma is influenced strongly because so many of us are students of this teacher, the resident teacher, abbess here. But the teachings don't say the teacher. They say teachers. Your teachers. And this idea that Venerable alluded to, you know, this idea that anybody who teaches you one verse of the Dharma is your teacher. You know, that's pretty strong. But in fact, we can cultivate this kind of respect for the Dharma with every single teacher that gives us the teachings. So, you know, you're the local person in your Dharma center doesn't really sing for you, but you're still learning Dharma from that person. So definitely meditate on cultivating respect for that person. Definitely meditate on the kindness of that person. Even if you know you're still looking, then cultivating those qualities in relationship to whatever teacher will only benefit your mind. And then actually make you more receptive to what that person has to teach. Because I have seen, this is heartbreaking, I've seen so many people travel around the world looking for their root guru. Like, I don't know what looking for, you know, looking for that chill bump moment where I meet my teacher and my teacher recognizes me and says, oh, I remember you from this life, blah, 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 blah. And at least two people I know of, 10 years later, come back and said, you know what, my root teacher is the one I've been going to at my Dharma center every week. I can't say that it was a waste of time to spend all that time going around the world. I'm sure it was terribly, terribly beneficial. But somehow, to be able to practice these closer to the beginning, to make ourselves receptive, then we receive teachings from whoever happens to be there. And so maybe it's not that personal close teacher that you rely on 100%, that, you know, you can't trust them in the way that you want to, and we're talking about the ideal teacher. But you can get a lot of dharma from people. So I think that's a thing to broaden it.
Yeah, the thing that impressed me in these teachings was, is the thing is to be receptacle for the teachings,
yeah,
not the teacher.
Yeah.
And we, yeah, I think sometimes we're always so focused on the teacher, but actually we kind of got it wrong.
Yeah, 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 it's the teachings that come through. Yep.
Also, some of the attitudes that this teaches us to cultivate is respect, service, and humility. And those are three attitudes that we need to benefit other sentient beings. And if we don't have a teacher, but we have the Dharma, we still have community that we work in and live in. And if we cultivate humility, respect, and service in those relationships, we build the foundation that leads to these larger examples of it within relationships with teachers. So I think if you look at your work life, if you look at your home life, if you look at your family life, if you look at your friendship life, and start to practice those three things with a certain amount of wisdom, of course, that you're building the foundation that you need for the relationship with the teacher.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was really thinking about that Venerable alluded to a little bit in BBC, but it's more I thought about these teachings, the more it occurred to me, is also respecting the Dharma and the friends of, and the minds of our Dharma friends. Really, really cultivating that appreciation for the kindness of that. At whatever level, but it's a different kind of relationship. Yeah. Don't talk.
In my mind, the part of the relying on teacher about looking at the qualities, good qualities of having a teacher and disadvantages of not having a teacher, kind of doing that in our own mind, whether or not we have the long rim or not, aspiring to take a teacher, aspiring to find something to guide us in the right direction, will make it so that the qualities will arise spontaneously upon finding a teacher, whether that teacher be alive or a book, or the feeling of wanting that will automatically bring those things to the surface. That, you know, you've been wanting this for so long, when you finally get it, you're going to have respect for it. You're not just going to go, oh, this was really great, and then, you know, toss it to the side. You're going to show respect for it because you've been longing for so long trying to find it. I think a lot of those things can come from practicing other things that don't necessarily look like they, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. But when you really strive diligently in very specific places, the results can come out in varied ways, I think.
Yeah, and what you're saying reminds me again that the emphasis here is this is what's going on in our own minds, debating these attitudes with or without the teacher. So even, you know, in the discussion the other day, it was really hard to keep our minds off the qualities of the teachers we liked or didn't like, and really find out what was going on in our own minds about what made us receptive to the teachers that spoke to us. Same thing here. It's really hard for us to remember, because we're always projecting out on that person. But this description of how to practice is how to cultivate that mind that John Paul's describing.
To the earnestness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the thing that was interesting about how I came to find Venerable is that I asked her to be my root teacher before I knew what I was doing. And it was a moment of the way that I live my life is a moment where I feel connected to something that I don't have any words for. But what has happened over the past 10 years is that she has helped me discover the qualities that are important for my relationship to this path. So it was like I'm a notorious person who comes in the back door of things. That's how I met the Dharma. That's how I learned most of the practices, is that I came in the back door. I've always been somewhat, I've snuck in. And so when I asked her to be my teacher, I think I'd only known her a year and a half, maybe 2 years. I had no idea what I was asking. But I knew that the question was coming out of my mouth before I realized it. And she looked at me with a smile on her face. She said, "Of course I will." And then, at that very moment, that relationship began. It was all about Venerable Chogyam showing Nance how to cultivate the qualities that she didn't think she had. So my whole relationship to Venerable has been not only learning about the Dharma, but she's exposing me to myself. In a, you know, in a very skillful way. I think if I had waited to cultivate, you know, the humility and the service and the respect for her, I'd still be hanging out behind the backyard somewhere.
Mm.
So my own kind of predisposition or temperament or karma, whatever you want to call it, she took that moment when I asked that question, because if she had said, "You're not ready," I would have been gone. Maybe other people she can say, "Think about it," or "Are you sure?" or "Come back next year," and they will. Nancy wouldn't have done that. And so she did a very skillful, wise thing, and only now do I realize, you know, the depth of her absolute confidence in the fact that I was going to be able to pull this off. You know, I had no idea. But boy, she had absolutely, the way that she said that, it was right at that, in this car at night, driving her home from a talk where it's raining and pouring. I hardly know her. I just said, and that was it. And that was the beginning. So I, as much as I think the broad, the karmic display of how we meet them and the environments and the surroundings and how our minds are, I mean, that's the beauty of the relationship in and of itself, is that they know, or at least she knew me. I don't know about anybody else, but I would not have been able to sustain the "I don't think you're ready, come back later" response. And so now she says, "I'm not ready, come back later." I know, but that's, I'm just going to park myself. Anyway, that's been my somewhat.
No, that's one of the great advantages of having a teacher, which is where we're going. So, so the benefits, Venerable John Powell read them through the textbooks ones last night. I'll go through them again. And then there are a couple of really key ones I thought would be worth exploring. You will come closer to Buddhahood, which in our discussion yesterday, a lot of people said that was their goal. So if that's our goal, that's a pretty good advantage of relying on the teacher. You will please the Buddhas. Not the Buddhas need our pleasure, but again, if we have that aspiration, and that's, you know, it's something that benefits us to have a mind that wants to please the Buddhas. This is the one that I think personally is very striking. If you don't rely, the benefit of relying on the teacher is that you will not be bereft of teachers in the future. So that by relying properly on the teacher now, while we have the opportunity, we are creating the causes to be able to meet with teachers in the future, to be able to rely on them, to recognize them, to be able to take their teaching. So if we're really serious about our path to enlightenment, then we better be setting ourselves up for the future to be able to meet them again and again and again. Relying on them properly does that. It's one of the big benefits. You will not fall into miserable realms, not because you know the right people who can get you out, but because by practicing what they teach, you'll avoid the negative rebirths. Same thought here, neither bad karma nor afflictions will overpower you. Why? Because you know how to work with them. You know how to work with them and transform them because you're relying properly on your teacher. Through mindfulness of the bodhisattva deeds and not contradicting them, your collection of good qualities will continue to increase. You will reach all your provisional and final goals. This is a long one. After obtaining virtue through serving and respecting the teacher with thought and practice, you will accomplish others' welfare as well as your own and complete the collections of merit of the sublime wisdom. I believe that means you'll become a Buddha. Geshe Thakchak also said that by respecting and serving your teachers, you exhaust karma whose effects you would otherwise experience in the miserable realms. Interesting, huh? So that he's saying that by serving and relying on our teacher properly, we're actually purifying negative karma. So your action of serving the teacher expends your miserable karma and replaces it with only slight harm to your body and mind in this lifetime, either in actuality or in dreams. So, you know, you come here, you get sick. Well, that's exactly what we're talking about here. Your action of serving the teacher is helping you ripen some karma. You come here and break your ankle. You come here and get kicked by a horse. I mean, you, well, things that have happened to people. Yeah. So this is an opportunity to rejoice if on the basis of relying and serving your teacher you're experiencing difficulties or challenges or even I think Venerable has said this, you know, that the berating sometimes that the teacher gives or the criticism and the pain that we feel from that is expending our negative karma if we can use it properly. You know, if we turn around and get angry and hate our teacher, then we've kind of missed the opportunity and created more negative karma. But if you really start thinking about cause and effect and the benefits, you know, what happens in our mind, creating the seeds of virtue in the future, or positive outcomes in the future, that is a very, very good benefit of having respecting and serving your teacher. And then the Sutra of Sithigarbha says, notice that all the Buddha's immeasurable good qualities of transforming others' minds arise from the proper reliance on the teacher. All the Buddha's good qualities of transforming others' minds arise from properly relying on the teacher. Therefore, rely on, become close to, serve and venerate the Guru just as you would the Buddha. The faults of not relying on the teachers. I have to say, there are some lists of grim, horrible things that will happen to you if you don't rely on your teacher properly that I didn't even write down. They were so over the top. They may be well true. I just couldn't even say them. You'll die by poison, burned by fire. I mean, they were just like, oh, yeah, I'm not going there. But there were some that I could really relate to. And this one, there's so much about the student getting angry with the teacher, being resentful and hostile and stuff. So this is a real danger point. Caution point for us to be aware of, because the closer you get, the easier it is for that to happen. So the Sutra on the Concentration Which Perceives the Buddha of the Present Face to Face, who wrote that title? Sutra on the Concentration Which Perceives the Buddha of the Present Face to Face says, if the student remains resentful, intractable, or hostile towards the guru, they have no way to obtain good qualities. No way to obtain good qualities for the very reasons that we've been talking about. So that's a fault of not relying on the teacher. And, you know, as the list of on that Lam Rim Atlan that we studied, that Venerable Jampel read last night, you know, if you don't rely on your teacher, many of the above benefits will accrue. You will not come closer to Buddhahood. You will not be pleasing the Buddhas. You will be bereft of teachers in the future. This is a scary thing. If we don't rely on our teachers properly now, or if we walk out the door angry and don't repair the relationship, then we're creating the causes for not having teachers in the future. And this, it's just so easy to do these. I've seen Dharma centers where the relationship with the teacher parting caused so much reaction among the community. Everybody feels justified in that reaction. Everybody feels... And yet, when somebody else came in to mediate, the point she made was, you're creating causes not to have teachers. So whatever you need to do, clean this up. Clean this up. It's fine if you think the teacher isn't right for you, or you're going to move for other teachers, that's fine. Just quietly and kindly withdraw. There's no need to talk badly about them. There's no need to cultivate hostility about them. There's none of that. Because that's what gets us in trouble. It's not like once you have a teacher, you're married to them forever. That is not so. You can back away. But cultivating anger and hostility and so forth is deadly for our future lives. And then the other warning, they talk about the faults of not relying on the teacher. What comes up here is also a warning about relying on bad friends. And especially since this came up for you in the Q&A, I thought this was worth exploring a little bit. Now I'm running over a second. But if we rely on bad friends, our good qualities will slowly diminish, all your faults will increase, and everything that is unwanted will develop. So what is a bad friend? A bad friend are the ones who say, I thought we were going camping this weekend, why are you doing that retreat? And really give you grief about it. The bad friends are the ones that talk badly about your teacher over and over and over until they really start to turn your mind. The bad friends are the ones that talk badly about your Dharma practice over and over and over until it turns your mind. So it's not like you can't have friends that don't practice. But it is really true that we are easily influenced by the opinions of the people around us. And that can pull you away from your teacher. It can. A partner that doesn't want you to be gone for the weekend. So those are just things to be aware of. Of places that you wouldn't expect. The water is seeping into that little crack in the rock. And if we're not mindful, the rock can crack. The great Nirvana Sutra says that the bodhisattvas do not fear mad elephants and the like in the same way that they fear bad friends. The former merely destroy the body, whereas the latter destroy both virtue and a pure mind. Moreover, mad elephant and bad friend destroy the body of flesh and the body of teachings, respectively. So those situations, those even those Dharma friends, that once the poison talk about the teacher starts happening, it spreads. So that's just something to be aware of in terms of taking very, very good care to rely on our teacher by cultivating their faith, our faith in the teacher and the teaching, cultivating respect by thinking about their kindness, and then relying on their practice by making offerings, offering service, and practicing what they teach to the best of our ability.